We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Good evening. I hope you'll excuse me if I appear a trifle excited.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Whatever appears emerges as raw experience for those who watch it.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight.
Hello and welcome to Sordid Cinema. My name is Simon Howell. I'm joined as always by Mr. Ricky D.
What's up, Simon? It's a good weekend, man. Good weekend. Recording a podcast, talking about one of my favorite movies of the year, or of last year. And this amazing game came out called The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, which is, I would say, better than the movie we're going to talk about. But that's a discussion for a different podcast, which you can also listen to, called the NXpress Podcast over at GoombaStomp.com. Just a shameful plug here.
The Legend of Zelda? What is this Legend of Zelda? We are also joined by Mr. Mike Warby.
Hello, and I am also playing Legend of Zelda, and it is indeed fantastic.
This is the only thing that can pull me away from The Legend of Zelda. It's talking about Moonlight. And for our listeners who are curious, we're going to talk about Logan next week because the entire crew over at GS is really busy playing Breath of the Wild. No joke.
Yeah, that's literally what is happening right now. So, except for me, I don't do games. Sorry. Maybe just a quick word about last week's show. Just very briefly, and then we can move on.
Did you think it was one of our best episodes?
I struggled. Bit of a struggle.
Yeah. All right, so Simon and I just want to apologize to our listeners. I don't exactly know what to say. We just want to say sorry. The show didn't go as well as we wanted it to go. We've been doing the show for about 10 years, which is crazy.
In one form or another, yeah.
We took a year off. We've had some great episodes, some bad episodes, very few bad episodes. That was one episode which I wish we could take back, but I don't want to blame anybody. Hopefully in the future, we'll do a better job.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a combination of factors. For what it's worth, my co-host Sean Coletti of TV Roundtable said he very much enjoyed the episode. Anyway, that's enough about that. This week, we are here to talk about Barry Jenkins' Moonlight, which, of course, just hilariously won Best Picture. I have a lot I want to talk about, both about this movie and about some of the other movies that have been discussed kind of in the periphery because of the Oscars and just because award season is now officially, mercifully, finally over, and we can... You know, we're like 4 months away from the next one starting, because it's just like election season. It never ends. But I'm sure that we'll have occasion to veer off into any number of topics. But is there anything else we should mention before we get started?
We can listen to our podcast over on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and of course on the website sordidcinema.com. or GoombaStomp.com, and give us a rating. You can like us on our Facebook page, but you can also join our Facebook group. All of the links are over on the post for this specific episode. Once again, SordidCinema.com.
Fantastic. I just want to briefly, as I have for the last couple of weeks, briefly plug The Lodgers, which is my new podcast with Kate Renabom about Twin Peaks. We are about to record our fourth episode today, and it's been really great, and I think if you have any interest in that subject matter, you'll very much enjoy it. It's also on iTunes and Stitcher, and you can also like and subscribe and stuff. Okay, that's it. That's enough plugging. Let us get to Moonlight.
What you looking at me like that for? What, man? Come on, you just drove down here? Yeah.
Who is you, Sharon?
For a long time, trying not to remember. Try to forget all those times.
So some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you gonna be. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
You gonna tell him why the other boys kick his ass all the time?
What's wrong?
I'm good.
No, I ain't seen good, and you ain't it.
Remember the last time I saw you?
Listen.
To who, Ma? Huh? To you?
Who is you, man? I ain't seen you in like a decade. It's not what I expected. What did you expect?
You're back on Sorted Cinema. That was a clip from Moonlight. Directed by Barry Jenkins, which of course just won Best Picture in spectacularly hilarious fashion. So for anyone who hasn't seen it yet, it is a what I would call a tripartite or in three parts film about Chiron, aka Little, aka Black, a black gay man, I guess boy for the first couple parts of the film. We see him as a how old do we say he is? Like 11 or 12 year old boy? Maybe a little younger. Somewhere between 10 and 12. Then as a teen and then as an adult in three roughly equal parts of the film. He's played by three different actors, Trevante Rhodes, Ashton Sanders, and Alex Hibbert. We also follow, to one degree or another, his childhood best friend, Kevin, who is played by Jaden Piner as a kid, Jarell Jerome as a teenager, and Andre Holland. Also, Janelle Monáe, and of course, and of course, Mahershala Ali, who just won Best Supporting Actor.
Can we just call him Prince Ali? You know Prince Ali, right?
Yeah.
Okay. For anyone who doesn't know, he used to be a hip-hop artist. His music is actually really good.
I mean, I've actually gotten used to saying Mahershala Ali. It had been like a week, so I'm getting used to it. But anyway. So, yeah, Moonlight. Let's do it. Ricky, I know that you, as recently as even a few weeks ago, you were telling me that for all the talk about this movie, you had no idea what it was about, the basic concept. You hadn't seen any footage. It was a total mystery to you, which is kind of an unusual position to have for, like, a Best Picture nominee. From the viewpoint of a film nerd, so I mean, what did you go in expecting, if anything?
Okay, well, first of all, like, there's a reason why we stopped recording the Sorted Cinema podcast for about a year. I've been really busy. I've been at school, and it's been really intense. So I'm way behind on movie watching. My school ended about 4 weeks ago, so I've been catching up on some of the essential viewing, I guess you could say. And so, yeah, I had no time to read about the movie, and honestly, I did not want to read about the movie. I wanted to go into the movie blind. I just know a lot of people were talking about it. I didn't even know it was nominated for Oscars. I only found out the Oscar nominations like about 2 days before the actual Oscars and decided to watch the Oscars only because Moonlight was actually nominated for Best Picture. So I was pleasantly surprised when I sat down to finally watch this movie. And to be totally honest with you and our listeners, Moonlight is one of the reasons why I wanted to bring back the Sorted Cinema podcast. The second reason is just because I miss talking to my friends about movies, and I think it's really fun to do. So I wasn't really sure what to expect, but I gotta tell you, this is one of my favorite films of the past 10 years. I think it's not my favorite film of 2016. My favorite film of 2016 is Green Room, but this is by far the best film I saw that was released in 2016, although I only saw it in 2017. I love this movie. You know, here's a film that, yes, it is indeed about the struggles and difficulties of this person embracing his sexuality. Like, I can't really call this like a gay film in the sense that this character doesn't really live a gay life. Like, it's not like he ever comes out of the closet and forms a relationship with a man. You know, there is a brief sexual encounter midway through the film, which we can talk about a little later on, but I feel like the story is universal in scope and intent. So we have a three-part journey here, and it's a story of survival. I think it's one of these movies where it finds these fleeting moments in somebody's life, but it's like small moments, but it's not really small if you think about it. Like, they're life-changing moments, but it's not like a car accident, or it's not like someone gets shot or robs a bank. It's small moments, but those small moments really defines this person's life. And there's a bit of dialogue that's said early on in the movie in which Prince Ali's character, Ruan, tells the young boy about this story that this woman told him when he was younger. And I'm not entirely sure how it goes word for word, but I do believe it's somewhere in the vein of, even in the moonlight, black boys look blue. And to me, that's like the central metaphor of the film, in the sense that people will view you and see you for the way they want to see you and view you, be it the color of your skin, your sexuality, but it's up to you to define who you want to be in your life. And I know that sounds maybe corny and maybe a simple way to define what this movie is really about, but I think this is a beautiful movie. Everything connects, from the music to the cinematography to the performances to the direction. I think Moonlight addresses, again, universal subjects. It's not just about a high school bully. It's not just about crime. It's not just about drugs. It's not just about the ghetto. It's not just about being black in America. It's about many, many things, including masculinity. It's about astrology. It's a coming of age story. It's a love story. But it's a story about what it means to be human. And it's like, I love character studies. Like, I'm the type of person where, like, I'll be sitting in a bus and I can't help but stare at people. Like, not in a creepy way, but, you know, I'm like, I am staring at people and I'm sort of like studying these people. And in my head, I imagine what they are like and what their life is like. And, like, so I love movies that are character studies. And the last thing I'm going to say to open this up is, when I was watching this movie, I could not help but escape the Wong Kar-wai vibe. If I were to make a list of, like, say, my 100 favorite movies of all time, Chungking Express would be on that list, and so with Happy Together. And I could not help but see many, many similarities. And I think it was like a few days ago, I went on YouTube and some guy posted a video with comparing Moonlight to Wong Kar-wai's films, and it's striking. Like, there's so many scenes in this movie that are lifted from his movies. You know what I mean? Like direct lifts. Like, there's one specific scene, for example, when they're driving in a car, and it's filmed exactly like a scene in Happy Together. In fact, they have the exact same song playing in the background. So clearly, Wong Kar-wai was like a big, huge influence on the director of this movie.
It's the Katana Velosa song, right? So, Mike, are you as bowled over as Ricky is?
I was blown away by this film. I actually went in, even with knowing even less than Ricky did. I had caught a few TV spots for the film. I was going to watch a trailer, but about halfway through, I was kind of like, I don't want to know anything about this movie. I kind of like staying in the dark about it. So I went in almost completely in the dark. I thought all I knew about it is it was sort of a coming of age story, you know, about a young black boy. That's really all I knew about it. And I had nothing. I had no idea about the gay angle. And I was really surprised by it. And I was pleasantly surprised with how it was dealt with. Because I think what's really interesting, and I wrote an article about this a little while ago on Goombastop after the film won Best Picture. I think one of the most interesting parts of this film is what we've never really seen this sort of gay coming of age tale as told in this setting, where machismo and, you know, being seen as a tough guy and untouchable is so important, and it's so impossible to be soft and to let your emotions show. I think it's a really key element of this story and why it's so effective, because you don't see this, like, in ghetto stories, you don't see people being soft and showing their emotions and touching one another. It's really interesting, and it's not something that's ever been seen before, and it's really important, especially at this time in politics and when things are more jarring and everybody's been put in their own little box. It's really nice to see a story like this that takes on the sort of you know, people who kind of get swept to the side a lot in our society.
So I like this movie. I like this movie a lot. I'm not as positive on it as you guys are. And I think the main reason why is that I think stylistically, on a pure aesthetic level, it largely works for me. And I think on sort of a tactile level, I think it really works. I think that's the level on which it works the best, where as a movie about sort of discovering new planes of experience and planes of sort of sensation, I think it works really, really well. And that's a really rare way for a movie to work, which is why I really value this movie, especially as a movie to gain the acclaim that it has. Like, its themes and the way it handles them are very unusual. That being said, I'm going to offer some light criticism in that I don't think it really works as a character study, and I'm going to defend that point of view for the next half an hour or so. I think Chiron is not very specifically defined as a person, and I think it's partially done on purpose. Like, he's clearly meant to stand in for kind of, if not a universal experience, at least a very common one of sort of coming up against the harsher realities of life, and especially as you define the contours of your sexuality, or in his case, for much of his life, sort of ignore it or shunt it aside, which is definitely a choice. But I think for me, the way that Chiron is just so put upon, and so he's so thoroughly sort of an innocent victim for so much of this film. I mean, specifically for two-thirds of this film, we can talk about the third a little later, that it stacks the deck so much against him and so much in his favor as someone to be sympathized with for the audience, that it's almost unfair in terms of, like, I don't know if I want to go so far as to call it, like, manipulative in a bad way necessarily, but I do think it makes it an easier movie and a simpler movie than maybe it had to be. We can choose to see that as good or bad, but I don't know. I think just purely they had an opportunity to maybe define Chiron as a more living, breathing human, which is also challenged, to be fair, by having him being played by three different actors, one of whom is kind of an outlier. And again, we can talk about that later. I don't know. So that kind of held it back for me a little bit from greatness, but I did very much enjoy it, and there's definitely a lot to admire.
Here's the thing. The reason why I call it character study is because I think what makes the movie so great is I think the movie is really about how the world can shape us and how the world shapes him. And again, that might seem simplistic, but the world does change him. His surroundings change him. The people in his life change him. The people he comes across change him. The greatest achievement of this film is having three actors play Chiron, who also, by the way, all look different. Yeah, like, of course, clearly the young boy is going to look different than the older man in the third chapter of the film, but even the two adults in this movie look completely different. And I think that's really interesting and kind of ingenious that he actually cast actors that look so completely different, because in all three chapters of this story, something changes him dramatically. And so by having these three actors who look so different, it reinforces that theme of how life and the people who surround you and your surroundings and the world will shape you as a person.
Right. Did the two young actors really look so different to you? I thought they looked very similar.
No, I'm talking about the actor in the second segment, chapter two, and the actor who plays Chiron, a.k.a. Black, in the third chapter.
Oh, okay. Got it.
And I mean, they look completely different.
Yes,
he's
yes,
bulked up. He's a drug dealer. You know, he's just. But the thing is, so here's the thing. So I was reading a lot of interviews with the director, and he said that he was a little worried at first by casting these two men who look completely different playing this one character. But it's about their facial movements, their physical movements, their expressions, and the eyes. And so the idea is that these three actors, although they look completely different, are, of course, clearly three different people, right? It's not like he filmed this movie over, like, a period of, like, 12 years, like Richard Linklater's Boyhood, right? They still come across as the same person. And that has a lot to do with the direction and with the performances. And what's really amazing is that neither one of these actors ever met while filming the movie, because he actually filmed it in chronological order. So he filmed chapter one first, moved on to chapter two, and then ended with chapter three, but they never met. Like it's not like the actor in chapter three met the actor in chapter two and studied him, which I think is kind of brilliant, because when you watch this movie, they really do feel like, you know, the same person. And it has a lot to do with the eyes and their expressions and the way they don't talk. And like, just like body movement and everything. And like, the thing is like, Simon and I talked about this off air, but we really do think this movie has a lot more to say about masculinity. And so, you know, here's a kid who's bullied when he's like, what, 10, 12 years old. Everyone thinks he's gay. Clearly the kid is gay. And then there's like this life-defining moment in chapter 2, which once again revolves around his sexuality. And he's nicknamed Black in chapter 2, but by the time we get to chapter 3, he actually goes by the name Black. And here's a movie also about what it means to be a Black man in America. It's unsurprising that come chapter 3, when he isn't an adult and he is selling drugs and he's got this like more quote-unquote masculine, thuggish sort of like persona, his nickname is now Black. I think it's a character study more in the sense of how the director and the actors bring out this character more so than the events in the movie and or the dialogue. It's not like one of these movies where the character is defined by specific things that happen in his life, like once again a car accident or him getting married or him having a baby. It's different.
Right. And actually, I think it's very jarring when it switches to the third act, because you at a moment, like for the first moment, you don't even recognize Chiron. But I think that's actually to the film's strength, because the last we see of Chiron is after he breaks that chair over the bully's back, which I have to ask, was anybody else like, fuck yeah, when that happened?
I seem to remember having it's been a long time since I saw this with an audience, but I seem to recall there being a fuck yeah ambiance.
Nice. Yeah, because that's absolutely how I felt. I was like, yeah. Anyway, the last we see of him in the second part is after he breaks that chair over the bully's back and then gets put into the cop car. And then, you know, it shows after we see the time jump to see him all bulked up and looking more like Juan than anything, really. It's very interesting, because it's almost like after that event, like he's been pushed and pushed and pushed, and then finally he breaks, and it's like after that, it's almost like he's put all this armor on, in the form of muscles, and now the way he dresses and the way he talks and the way he carries himself, it's all like armor to keep people away from seeing that side of him. And then it's like, you know, this is never going to happen to me again, kind of thing.
I mean I kind of bristle at the idea that that the events we see in the movie don't directly result in who, like, I think this very much is a movie where specific things happen to a character and then we are meant to understand that is why they are the way they are later. Like that he breaks the chair on the bully's back, presumably goes to juvie, and that's the beginning of his criminal career. And when we see him later, he's a drug dealer. Like that seems to me to be like pretty much a one-to-one relationship.
For sure. But I think the point I was trying to make before, maybe I didn't do a good job in making my point, is that in most movies, you wouldn't see just the chair scene. You would see like the prison scene. You would see the scene in which the first time he sells drugs, the first time he, I don't know, commits a crime, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, even with the sexual encounter, like, what's interesting about the brief sexual encounter that he has with this boy named Kevin on the Florida beach is it happens about halfway through the movie. And so it feels like the first half of the movie is leading up to that specific moment. Like, it feels like this is going to be just a movie about this gay character and growing up. But then the second half of the movie, right up to the very end, moves away, completely away from that sexual encounter midway through the film. And I so, like, even though there's like three chapters, it kind of feels like the movie's divided in two, really.
I think I should just mention now that the beach sequence is, to me, like the easy highlight of this movie, because that's the scene that plays to Jenkins' strengths the most, which to me is just on the purely aesthetic side, and just the way those characters just. Again, the word that comes to mind is tactile. Like it's such a powerful sequence, because he's able to communicate what it means to these characters to be doing that, and it's much more powerful to me than any scene of dialogue in the film. I wanted to briefly mention since we started to talk about Chiron as an adult, I wanted to mention two things, and I think they both hammer home that this is not a subtle movie, and I don't think that's, I'm not necessarily complaining, I'm saying it to say, like, Jenkins is not interested in small gestures. He's looking to tell a universal story, and two things in particular, the nicknames, the fact that he's little when he's small and black when he's an adult, and we hear all three names, by the way, in that middle segment, which makes sense. These are not subtle nicknames. These are not subtle indications of what we're meant to understand about the character's evolution. The other thing would be, in terms of the music, and there's more to talk about here, but in a key sequence where we get Sharon in his car, he's listening to Classic Man by Jidenna, which, if you hear the original version, is like not, that is like basically the opposite of like a hardcore rap tune. It's totally not something that you would listen to as a drug dealer trying to be intimidating. But he doesn't listen to the original version. He listens to a screwed version, which means slowed down, which is a whole other thing that also connects to the score. And it makes the song sound a lot more menacing and stereotypically masculine than it actually is. And if you've heard the original song, you notice right away the difference. And again, it's not at all subtle in terms of trying to explain in oral form how he's throwing up this very elaborate facade and this very macho facade, but it works.
Well, in terms of things not being subtle, I mean, even his name Chiron, it shares the same name as the immortal Greek god, the centaur, right? So the story of that god is that, if I'm not mistaken, he's related to Zeus and Poseidon, and his story is basically one in which he is abandoned by his mom and later adopted by two different gods, and it's because of his appearance and because of his personality. And yet, even though he's the son of a god, because he was different, nobody accepted him. And he was different in the sense that he was gentler and less wild than most of the gods. So there are parallels even with his name Chiron to Greek mythology. And in that story, like, there's various versions of the myth. But I think to break down like the essential details, Chiron is fatally wounded by a poisoned arrow and he can't die. But he carries with him this injury for the rest of his life. So the whole entire story of this specific character, this god, is about him dealing with his pain and finding ways to cope with who he is. And so even with the name Chiron, there's a callback to Greek mythology, and there's, of course, a callback to astrology, which is why, you know, we could talk about why the movie is called Moonlight as well. Everything in this movie is not subtle, but everything's there for a specific reason, including the character's name.
I think moving away from the symbolism of it, I think going off of what Simon said about the beach encounter being the most powerful scene in the movie, I think there's certainly a case to be made for that scene, but I think there's two other scenes that really need to be highlighted for maybe that same distinction. And one would be one from his childhood time and one from the adult timeline. The one from the childhood timeline that really stood out to me was the final scene where he goes to Juan and asks him about... without using the word directly, because it's an offensive word, but he asks him about the way he's been treated and the way he's perceived, and uses a slur that people have been calling him. And that scene, the way it unfolds, and the realization to him that, even though Juan's become sort of a surrogate father for him, he's also the reason that he can't have a real mother. And the way that ties into the later scene, when his mother, in the adult timeline, where his mother says to him, "I love you, you don't have to love me, but you gotta know that I'm gonna love you." Like, where she sort of admits to all the ways she was a bad mother and not there for him as a child, and says, you know, like, I'm trying to make up for it, and I understand if you don't love me, but, I mean, both of those scenes I found incredibly powerful.
I saw your mom last night.
I hate her.
Hmm.
I hate her.
Yeah, I bet you do. I hated my mom, too. I miss it like hell now, though. That's all I'm gonna say about that. Thank you.
What's a faggot?
A faggot is a word used to make gay people feel bad.
Am I a faggot?
No. No. You could be gay, but you gotta let nobody call you no faggot. I mean, unless...
How do I know?
See, now, who was it that said for a great movie to be considered great, it's got to have at least three great scenes? Was it Jean-Luc Godard or François Truffaut? I think this movie has, like, four, if not five, great scenes, like, brilliant scenes. I think that's one of them. Simon, you're right. The brief sexual encounter is also an amazing scene. I love the baptism scene when he takes him to the ocean. And you have, like, because the thing about Juan is, like, he's not a stereotype. Like, he's not a typical, like, drug dealer. Like, he's actually got, like... Okay, maybe it's corny to say he has a heart of gold, but you kind of get to see the human side of him, right? And what's interesting about his character is so strong that he actually disappears. He's not present in Chapter 2 or Chapter 3, but his presence is always felt, especially in Chapter 3, because Chiron's character mirrors him, like, in terms of, like, his personality, his occupation, the way he looks, dresses, etc., etc. And normally I would say that when a movie's best character, one of the movie's best characters, goes missing, the movie suffers. But in this case, with Moonlight, it actually makes the movie better, because you still feel his presence. And there's something about the baptism scene that really spoke to me, and that's the moment in which I knew I loved this movie. That was the moment in which I was not too afraid to call this movie a masterpiece. Like, and I think it also has a lot to do with the cinematography, which we still have to talk about, and the soundtrack. There's something about this movie. First of all, I do not understand how this movie did not win Best Cinematography. I mean, I don't really care much about the Oscars, but I think that of all the movies that I've seen so far that were released in 2016, I don't think there's a movie in which the cinematography tells the narrative and pushes the narrative more so than the cinematography in Moonlight. Like, I think it's just essential and vital to the success of this film. Like, this is one of the most beautiful looking movies, first of all, I've seen in quite some time. I mean, once again, it reminds me a lot of, like, Wong Kar-wai's movies, like, in terms of, like, its visual style. Like, it doesn't look like In a Mood for Love in a sense that it doesn't have, like, these, like, red, powerful orange hues or colors or backdrops, right? In this case, it's more like blues and greens and, like, aqua tones, right? But it's not gritty. It's not one of these movies that takes place in the ghetto and it's all gritty and dark. It's completely different, and I love the visual style of this movie. Like there's something about that, specifically that second act, which I think is perhaps the most beautifully photographed of the three chapters, because in that second act, in Chapter 2, it does have a dreamlike quality to it, and it does use a lot of, like, blues and greens. Like, and I was reading up on the cinematography and how they specifically tried to find ways to heighten and enhance the skin tones of these actors. And the idea was to always have them sort of, like, framed or photographed in a way that they were sitting beneath the moonlight and or beneath the sunlight. Because it does take place in Miami. And if I'm not mistaken, it does take place in the past, right? Like, it's in the 80s or 90s, I believe. So it's not, like, present day. So there's just something beautiful about the look of this film, specifically about the lighting. It's so vibrant. It's so rich. It's so colorful.
I'm not sure I have anything to add about the cinematography. I mean, it's obviously a very beautiful film. It evokes... it evokes the quality of its title, which I think we can certainly talk about the significance of the title. But to my mind, even if there were no specific evocations of Moonlight in the movie, which there are, it would still work perfectly fine as a title. I don't really have anywhere to go with this, but something I've been thinking a lot about since I saw both movies is I keep thinking about Moonlight as not necessarily a companion piece, but as something that shares a lot of individual themes with one of the other films that was nominated for Best Picture, which is Manchester by the Sea. And I know that's kind of a weird comparison because on the surface, they don't really have much in common. Stylistically, they're nothing alike. And let's be clear, and, like, just to state the obvious, Manchester by the Sea is very obviously a very white movie, and Moonlight isn't. But I thought it was fascinating that these were the two movies that, if you talk to critics, they were by far the most beloved of the nominees, like, in a totally different class. And they also both feature these themes of coming of age and masculinity and tragedy and trauma and the ways in which specific types of men maybe can't articulate their problems or their emotions in the way that they could or should. It does very, very different things with those concepts, but the fact that there were two movies like that kicking around, to my mind, they were both very unusual nominees.
You know what the key difference for me between those two movies are? I think like first of all, Manchester by the Sea uses flashbacks, and it uses flashbacks to show us those key moments in this man's life or this family's life in which everything does change and for the worse. But he uses those flashbacks, whereas Moonlight, it's told in three chapters from beginning to end in chronological order and never flashes back. Each chapter sounds and looks completely different. That goes back to the cinematography and again the soundtrack. I think the difference for me is that, like, in Moonlight, it kind of feels like the characters and the performers, the actors, are really trying to drive the story or move the story forward, whereas with Manchester by the Sea, it really does use those specific moments in somebody's life to really try to make the audience feel. And that might be an unfair criticism because Moonlight does it too, but I feel like what makes me feel about this character in Moonlight, it's not those specific scenes, it's not the tragedy, it's just the performance from him and the actors who surround him, including Naomi Harris, who plays his mom, who we still haven't talked about, who I think is fantastic in this movie.
She's actually one of the characters I struggled with because from scene to scene, she's one of the few characters that does kind of feel like the one that I've seen before, and like feels, you know, the way that she's a junkie, and then later she's kind of like a stray saint. I don't know, but to the point of comparing the films, I would only say that Manchester by the Sea is a movie about, and Lonergan has talked about this, about how sometimes when people have certain things happen to them, they overcome great adversity, and that's what a lot of movies are about. He wanted to make a movie about someone who encounters great adversity, and then they just do not change for the better. It makes me think of there's this horrific account of a limousine crash, which I don't want to get into, but the family of the young victim is talking about it later, and they said, you know what, this sets the agenda for the rest of our lives. And sometimes that's just what happens, and it's not something you really see in terms of characters who don't change for the better. Moonlight is very much the opposite story. It's a more hopeful story about how people not necessarily can change, but can allow themselves to invite change into their life and can sort of break out of their own habits. So they're, I don't know, to me they're kind of similarly themed movies with totally different conclusions.
Yeah, but Moonlight's power doesn't come through surprising or unsurprising, unexpected narrative developments. Like, it's like about how we identify with this character or feel for this character. Like, I feel like Manchester is doing something completely different.
I think they're both great films, to be honest. I think of the nine nominees, or certainly of the six that I've seen anyway, those were certainly the two best films of the year. Like, of those films anyway. To go off what you guys are saying, though, I think the way this finally comes to a head at the end when they're allowed that moment together, and the way it calls back, I guess the way that it does give hope by showing, like, symbolically, it's really obvious symbolism, but I really like the symbology of it, that you see Chiron as a little boy again, and it's like finally after this part of him was sort of hammered away and broken down and put out and buried inside of him, we see that come out at the end, and it's a very hopeful message, and I think that's a big part of where the power of the film comes from. To me, what this film is ultimately about is, like, I can only think of two other situations in my memory where I've seen a gay black character who has a prominent role. One is in 6 Feet Under in the character of Keith, and the other one is Omar Little on The Wire. Now, in both cases, the characters are very similar to Chiron in the way that they, despite the fact that they're gay, they armor themselves in this really hard, tough guy persona. And I think that's a really interesting message. And I think ultimately that's what this movie is about. It's like how maybe a lot of what the problems that people are having in Black America, and, like, you know, the crime rate and people turning to a life of crime at an early age, I think ultimately the message of the movie is that a lot of these young men are sort of forced into a life like that because they don't have an outlet where they can express themselves and be themselves. They all have to put on this posture in order to survive in these hard neighborhoods. And I think it's really sad, but that's what I took away from the film, is that he's finally freed at the end, at least briefly freed, when he gets to finally just be himself for a moment, for probably the first time in at least 10 years.
Right, which goes back to what I said at the beginning of this podcast. Like, the thing about this movie is that it's like sort of like Boyhood, in the sense that the movie is driven more by the flow of experience than, say, the mechanics of a plot in terms of us, like the viewers. I kind of feel like the movie is really about how, at the end of the day, you have to define who you are as a person, despite what happens to you. And so, to me, that's what I walked away thinking. Like, at the end of the day, like, this character decided to be who he is on the outside. Like, he appears to be this tough, stereotypical, like, black man living in America who's selling drugs and is involved in crime. But deep down inside, he's still the same Chiron we knew from chapter one. And technically, he's never really changed who he is as a person.
Yeah, and... again, I find it fascinating the way that I don't mean to keep bringing this up. I just keep thinking about it. You know, this is a movie about sort of overcoming adversity and sort of like triumphing over the forces that seek to oppress you. Whereas Manchester by the Sea is the exact opposite. It's about a guy who experiences such loss that he's partially implicated in. And then has effectively given up on all aspects, on it, at least the vast majority of aspects of life, even while the people around him in his life who have also been touched by loss have found ways to move on and be productive. And
I think maybe that's why I don't like the movie, though. It has a completely different, complete opposite sort of like viewpoint, at least in the viewpoint of the characters, in terms of how they define their lives. Like, Casey Affleck's character in that movie just lets these horrible things that happened in the past define him as a person moving forward. He doesn't try to change. He wants to suffer because he feels so guilty. I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it, but he feels guilty as to what exactly happened to his family in that movie.
Hold on, I think there is a real, I think there is a correlation to what Simon's saying, because to a certain extent, Chiron is punishing himself as well, and only, again, both characters only come out of it towards the end of the film to varying degrees, because Chiron has also let the events of the past put him into this, like, box, not quite as severely as Casey Affleck's character, but I think there's a real parallel there, actually.
But I think the ending of Moonlight is a lot more hopeful.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the Casey Affleck character does not change. Like, he makes certain concessions to reality, but he does not change. That being said, the one aspect of the third act of Moonlight that I find that I really do struggle with is the fact that all this time, Chiron has been literally celibate, which is revealed through dialogue, which I do find a little bit...
Hold on. I don't think he was celibate. Yeah. He was necessarily... He was celibate from gay... From a gay relationship. One of the things I actually really loved about this depiction of sexuality is both characters... Neither character is depicted as being purely 100% homosexual. It's like, I've always liked when sexuality is depicted that way, because I don't think sexuality is a 100% ratio game. It's like, I've always seen it as like varying ratios for varying people.
Simon, if I gave you a beer for every person in my life that I know that's similar to that character in a sense that he had one sexual experience with someone at a younger age and never experienced it for, like, say, 10, 20 years later on in his life with another man, you would be pissed drunk by the time this podcast was over.
I think you may have underestimated my tolerance. I'll also pick you up on that at some point.
Also, this movie has one of the greatest soundtracks ever. And, like, I do mean one of the greatest. Like, I love the mix of classical music. Like, I think you called it... What's the exact specific name of the genre?
Okay, so I'm going to scoot up my stool and be Professor Rap for a moment. So once upon a time, there was a guy named DJ Screw, and he made these mixtapes that were chopped and screwed. Essentially, chopped meaning like the beat was the rhythm was chopped up, and altered and screwed, meaning that the pitch was slowed down. And the reason he did this is because he drank a lot of codeine, and aka purple drank, aka many other things. It's a whole thing. And the whole idea is that when you're on codeine and you listen, the slowed down music has a pleasing property. Having never done codeine, I couldn't exactly describe the property to you. But the score for this film, as well as the mix of the Jidenna song that I mentioned, they do incorporate that pitched down element. It's not complicated. You literally just lower the pitch, and it both makes the tune slower and makes everything lower. I'm not sure that the use of it in the movie is that profound, but it is cool.
No, but it sounds great. So the soundtrack takes inspiration from the specific type of hip hop music, and so they do slow down the tracks, but they become fascinating, like more versions of the original tunes, right? So I kind of like, I don't know if that thematically fits in with the character, but I do think it works, at least in the sense that it sounds great. Like this whole entire film sounds great. And I love, for example, like the baptism scene when they're swimming in the ocean and you hear the classical music. And then you have like the violin that cuts in, and there's just something about that, like the piano with the violin. It just works beautifully, especially juxtaposing against that image of them swimming in the ocean. And by the way, apparently it only took him like 90 minutes to film that specific scene, or he only had 90 minutes. And the kid in the movie actually doesn't know how to swim. So he's actually learning how to swim in that scene in real life.
Give me a head. Hey, let your head rest in my hand. Relax. I got you, I promise. I'm not gonna let you go. Hey, man, I got you. There you go. 10 seconds. And that right there? You're in the middle of the world, man. That's good.
I mean, I would be interested to know if the screwed soundtrack elements were meant to have a specific thematic resonance of some kind. I couldn't tell you what it is. I mean, this to me is not a film that's really about hip hop culture in any meaningful way. But like you said, it sounds cool.
You know what's interesting is I finally, just sitting here right now, listening to you talk about the music, Ricky, I finally figured out where the music from this film reminds me of, and it's The Village. Do you guys remember the violin music in The Village? How it was used? Really. That's actually, I couldn't think of it for the life of me. I knew the music reminded me of something, but if you have the tolerance for Shyamalan to go back and rewatch The Village, I think you'll see that the way music is used here is actually very similar. Like the use of the violin specifically is very similar to the way it's used in The Village.
Except for the opening track in Moonlight is nothing at all similar to like anything heard in The Village. The opening track in Moonlight is the track that's taken from like a 70s blaxploitation film.
Yeah, and it's the same track that opens To Pimp a Butterfly, as well as an altered version of it also opens up a Roots album. So not exactly a... it's sort of a recurring touchstone in some recent hip hop records as well,
which is really weird because I've watched so many blaxploitation films. I've never even seen and heard of this movie until I heard the track, because the title of the song is named after the actual movie, and apparently the movie was never released here in North America, not that I'm aware of. But I'm kind of curious to see it because for some reason this song became very popular over the past few years.
So is there anything else we want to mention before? Because we're already nearing the hour mark. If there's anything else anyone feels a burning desire to get in there.
I just think, like, once again, I think this is one of the most beautiful looking movies I've ever seen. I love the cinematography. I love the music. I think the cast is great. I know you have a problem with Naomi Harris's character, but I think she still does a fantastic job for what she's given to do. So from my understanding, the director was the programmer, one of the programmers over at Telluride Film Festival, and he used to program the short films. And I know he's made short films in the past, but has he made a feature film prior to Moonlight?
He did have one previous film. He did do one previous feature, Medicine for Melancholy, which I have not seen.
I haven't seen it either, but I guess if there's one last thing I wanted to put in is that I've seen... pretty much all of the Best Picture winners in my lifetime. And I would say this is one of the five best, certainly, in my lifetime. I'm not going to be, like, hyperbolic enough to say it's one of the five best films I've seen in my lifetime, because that'll remain to be seen, like, how it holds up over time and how it ages and whatnot. But I think this is one of the, certainly, one of the best picture movies I've seen ever. And the only one in recent memory that I can think of that gives it a run for its money is No Country for Old Men.
There's a lot of fucking mediocre-ass movies in there, though.
Yeah, well, it's almost as good as Shakespeare in Love. Okay, not as good.
It's almost as good as The King's Speech.
It's almost as good as The King's Speech, yeah. I mean, look, if I were to make a list of my 100 favorite films of all time, it would not even be on my top 100. It would probably not even be on my top 500, but I do agree with you when it comes to the Academy Awards and their choices for nominations and or winners. It is by far one of the best.
Yeah, I mean, let's be clear, it's accidental that they made a good choice. Like, it's, let's not give them any credit. They wanted to stick it to conservatives, so they chose the very black movie with that also has gay themes. Like, it was not made on aesthetic grounds in an intelligent way. If Hillary Clinton had won the presidency, La La Land would have won. I promise you that.
I'm not entirely sure if you're joking or what, but sure.
I am not at all joking. I am being 100% serious, and so, I'm so sorry for getting politics involved again.
I'm not entirely sure if that's true, and I don't think we can ever prove it, but I do think that I saw La La Land, and I think this is a far superior film. Regardless, whatever, it deserves it, right?
I am just happy that I don't have to ever watch La La Land now.
Yeah, La La Land is not a bad film, but it is not deserving of the acclaim it got. It's a good film. It's a pretty good musical, but it's not a great film at all.
Slightly better than King's Speech.
Oh, fuck that movie, man. And fuck, what's his name? I'm so glad he's just not doing shit anymore. What's his name?
He's dead?
No. I wish he was dead. Tom, oh god, I've just remembered Les Miserables, so thanks. God damn it. Now I'm angry. Now I'm going to go into my other podcast angry, so thanks. Fuck. Anyway, the movie's called Moonlight. I hope y'all enjoyed it, and I hope y'all enjoyed this podcast. Future episodes that we may want to tease, I know we're planning to talk about Logan, which I'm going to be perfectly honest with you, I have absolutely no feelings about seeing one way or another. But who knows, maybe I'll be bowled over.
We're going to talk about Logan next week. We might touch on Legion, and it's going to be a fun show, and we're going to have a comic book expert Logan Dalton join us. So I'm super excited.
Yeah. You may notice that his name is also Logan. Do you see what we did there? Do you see? Thank you, Mike, for joining us. For the sort of quality repartee we're known for.
Thank you. I mean, I'm glad to be here. I was happy to come on to talk about. It's always nice to go on a podcast to talk about something that you're passionate about instead of something you're just kind of middle of the road with. So I'm happy to come on, especially to talk about a film that I thought was really, really fantastic.
And let's be fair, Mike's nickname is Black over Goomba Stomp, so.
Is that true?
No, that's bullshit. That is total bullshit.
Are you on the Twitters?
Yeah, I go by Gameskeeper Mike on Twitter, and I actually host another podcast on the site for people who may be into the video gaming side of things as well, called Random Encounters.
Fantastic. Ricky, you run Goomba Stomp Mag, that's our Twitter feed. Mm-hmm. And I'm also on Twitter as @HollowMines, but as I always say, please don't follow me. So thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back next week.
What happened? Huh? What happened, Chiron? Why you didn't come home like you're supposed to? Huh? And who is you?
Nobody. I found him yesterday. Found him in a hole on 15. Yeah, that one. Some boys chased him in the cut. He scared more than anything. He wouldn't tell me where he lived till this morning.
Well, thanks for seeing to him. He usually can take care of himself. He good that way, but.